Up again, Lucy kisses like no one can.
And the rarely heard lyrics sung by Desi Arnaz to the theme to the TV show I Love Lucy, starting off this hour of the Afternoon Magazine, because our subject is the formative years of television, and I Love Lucy is probably the most enduring program to come out of the television era of the 1950s. It's still on the air on cable. One of the local stations here in East Central Illinois, WCFN, is also airing it on weekday mornings. Our guest, James Boffman, a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a director of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication, has written about the first dozen years or so of American television. The book is called Same Time, Same Station, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. James Boffman, good afternoon, and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Good afternoon, Jim. Good to be with you.
And tell me, I used I Love Lucy as an example. You do write about it. Besides the fact that it is so popular now, what does it tell us about that era of television?
Well, I Love Lucy actually carries great historical value for understanding television. What I Love Lucy in the long run confirmed was that a weekly film series could be immensely profitable, and that television could move to a film and then eventually videotaped performance, and consumers, if the program was good, preferred it to any other production value. There had been an argument in some circles that TV production should be live, that's what consumers wanted, that they wanted the feeling of theater, the stage. But I Love Lucy proved overwhelmingly that, and the resilience of the reruns proved that film series was the way of the future.
And there was a lot of filmed TV from the beginning, but it just didn't have that sort of status?
No, it didn't. And in fact, most originations during the first 5, 6, 7 years were actually live telecast. They were not filmed, and part of that was expense. A film to show costs more than a live show. What most people weren't sure about was the residual value of reruns. There were a lot of industry insiders who thought the reruns wouldn't possess the value that they eventually did.
And that's something, I guess, to remember. And in radio and network radio continued through much of the 1950s, and of course, and it was to some degree the model for television. There really wasn't a concept of reruns.
Not really. That one of the things I had a chance to do in doing this book was to look at Jack Benny's business files, which are at UCLA and are fascinating. And if you ever get a chance to get out there, I recommend giving them a look. And the rules were very specific when Benny could rebroadcast a show, and it usually had to do with a national emergency or illness or something like that. They're very strict about that shows were to be aired live.
And you hear people complain about reruns on TV. It's a common term, but it works for the industry.
It does. And frankly, if the show's good, we've all done this. Well, at least maybe you've done. I will confess I've done it. If the show is good, you'll watch it. You'll watch a rerun. My wife is a pretty select viewer of TV. She won't just watch anything. But she's one of many people who will watch a rerun of Seinfeld, and she'll watch it again and again and again, to the point where, she can remember the lines. But she's not unusual in that regard.
Tell me about your personal memories. How much of TV from 48 to 61, the period you read about in your book, how much of it do you remember watching yourself?
Well, I'll tell you what, I hate to admit this, but even though I look much younger, but I was born in 52, or about, a third of the way into my story, and my parents didn't actually own a TV until 53. My earliest memories are foggy. I mean, I remember the Howdy Doody show. most of the shows it's interesting that I write about in the book, I saw as reruns, you know, like I Love Lucy, the George Burns show, Burns and Allen, excuse me. I do remember watching Peter Pan, which was an NBC production, but it was a revival, as it were. I mean, they restaged it. But not too many memories. Till the tail end of my story, that is to say the late 50s, I was a pretty heavy viewer. I remember the Westerns and the detective series that I write about toward the end of the book.
Well, the question is, the phrase does exist, golden age of television. Was there anything golden about it?
Boy, I don't know if you noticed, Jim, if you had in looking at the book, I really try to avoid that like the plague. I mean, I do allude to it. I think I think that the period was noted more for what it aspired to do rather than what it achieved. That is to say, I think that TV was culturally much more ambitious, maybe too self-consciously so, than it would be later, even in our own time.
So there was a feeling, and there was a feeling even in the industry as well as people talking about it, that this was a medium that could do great things and great things that, say, the movies and radio were not doing?
Absolutely, and that was particularly true at NBC under the leadership of Fat Weaver. Weaver was convinced that TV would be the highest form of entertainment, that it would fuse and invent new forms. I'm going to start sounding like Weaver if you don't stop me, but he was convinced of that. And more often than not, NBC's efforts didn't measure up. I mean, that was one of Weaver's problems, is he overpromised, and people were waiting for the creation to be reenacted. But there was part of, I think, what the book tries to capture is the guesswork and the idealism that surrounded the medium, and that frankly came with the beginning of radio and occasionally, affected the film industry and so forth.
You know, when you look at TV shows and basic types of TV shows, which have run for decades, and you look at radio shows that were running in the 1940s, I don't know if there's that much difference. There are dramas, there are, suspense, crime shows, comedies, variety shows, sports and news. What was, besides the fact that you could see it, what was different about TV programming?
Well, I think that that's a good question. I think TV would borrow from radio, but in the long run, that is to say, long run for my book, that is to say, the late 50s and early 60s, it was borrowing more from Hollywood than it was from radio. And just an interesting aside, most of the radio shows that were transferred to TV didn't last very long. Even Jack Benny, who was the most popular radio performer in the late 1940s, never matched his popularity on TV. He was popular, but he didn't dominate television the way he dominated radio. So I may not be answering your question, but I think there is no question that there was a similarity, and in a sense, the furniture was being moved into another room, but there were differences as well.
Not the same people. I guess the other person I can think of who was enduring was Bob Hope, although not as being on a weekly show, but
right.
He was on three or four times a year for decades.
Right. Hope was one of several performers who refused to do a weekly series. Just wouldn't do it. And interesting in that regard, he had a personal services contract with NBC, and they accommodated him in that regard. But Hope was one of many established performers who thought, if I come on every week, people will get sick of me.
And so he decided just to keep himself three or four times a year and try to make the shows more special, I guess.
Yeah, and it was what I didn't understand this initially, and I don't know why, because of course, I grew up watching performers like Hope, but TV was only part of Hope's business. He enjoyed performing live. He enjoyed doing movies, most of which during this period were terrible. I mean, it's one of the points that I think, got neglected when Hope died a few years ago. But he loved doing movies. And this is something else with his friend Bing Crosby. He loved playing golf. And a weekly series in those days involved a commitment to produce 30-some shows a year. Could be very time-consuming, exhausting. Several performers, older comics, actually had heart attacks trying to, you know, keep up with the production schedule. So Hope made a decision that he would do TV, but on a select basis. And it was one that Crosby for a long time practiced, and as did some others.
We're talking about what was there, what was different on the air. What was different in the industry? If you compare what was going on with radio and what was going on with television, what changed in the business of broadcasting with television?
Well, I think one significant change was several things, Jim, actually. Initially, you're right, radio was the most powerful model. It was the diffusion of television was powerfully affected by a big city bias. Initially, the big cities had television service, and big city tastes, whether for a very broad comic shtick that Milton Berle practiced, or for live drama, which all of the networks offered. This is the kind of fare that people in big cities liked. When TV reaches the smaller markets, you know, say parts of Illinois, parts of Wisconsin, where I live, those audiences didn't like Milton Berle. They didn't like live drama. They wanted westerns. They wanted detective shows. They wanted Lawrence Welk, who had a very, you know, as you know, a very mainstream musical program. That was one significant change. What's interesting is that the executives at the networks didn't get it. I mean, men and women who should have known better didn't realize at the time how that big city bias was affecting the programming popularity of their shows.
And I think of shows that, I guess, went beyond the big city bias, certainly in the 1960s, and, for instance, the rural sitcoms on CBS were things, I guess, that just were not thought of in the 1950s. But I gather maybe some earlier shows, shows like Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet, probably had an audience that went beyond the big cities.
Well, consider a show that I believe CBS turned down. That's The Real McCoys, about a family that moves to California, to the Valley in California, and they're sort of like country folk. And that show had a tremendous appeal in smaller markets, but it was also enjoyed by people living in urban markets as well. So The Real McCoys, in a lot of ways, was a precursor to the success of The Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction and other series that prospered in the 60s.
Now, the lag in getting to the smaller markets for TV, was that something that didn't happen the same way with radio, did it?
Well, it did to a certain extent. If you look at radio diffusion, it was slowed in the early 30s by the absence of electrical service, utility service in many rural areas. I didn't understand this at first, but there were western states that, because of the mountains, people in some, you know, had trouble getting stations at night and so forth. And so it was slowed. The cost of radios did start to go down in the early 30s, and that encouraged more people to buy radio receivers. But this is a somewhat similar pattern. It's not exact, but a somewhat similar pattern.
We're here in the Afternoon Magazine talking with James Boffman. He's a professor and director of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of Same Time, Same Station, Creating American Television, 1948 to 1961. I want to play a little clip right now, and this is a condensation from about an 8-minute promotional film that RCA put out, essentially telling people sometime in the mid-1950s all the wonderful things that they could watch on television if they only bought one. And I want to talk about some of the programs that are talked about, but also the host of this film who opens it up. And so the next voice you'll hear is that of Dave Garraway.
How do you do? My name is Dave Garraway, and I'm here and gladly so to tell you that television is ready for you. Now, all the excitement and all the laughs, all the mystery, all the things that make home a more exciting place to be and more fun to be are now ready for you. I'm in this television business. I work on this end of the machine. Every weekday morning, we do a show called Today. But most of the time, of course, I'm at home. And when I'm at home most of the time, like everybody with a TV set, I'm watching it most of the time, enjoying what this really fabulous instrument can do. The fun and the excitement of all the world that it brings into your living room. Let me show you a few of the many things and places and people that race through the tubes and the wires and end up before your very eyes every time you reach out and just turn the little knob of your TV set on. Any family in any room can capture the pure, wonderful enchantment of Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. This is a kid's show, technically, but I'm one of the millions of somewhat older kids who just wouldn't miss it for the world. Like most everyone I know, I'm in love with Fran and with Ollie. Ollie is the only one-toothed dragon in the world who sings opera, so what more could you ask? You want a box seat for every major sporting event? The pennant race, Branca pitching, Thompson up, and bang, the sports world blue sky high. Remember? Look at that. I saw it happen, and I jumped up and down in my living room. Up along Cassidy. There he is, one of television's greatest heroes. Now, I'm not going to tell you that I'm a cowboy fan, but I'll bet you can't find a kid who isn't, because Hoppy is a living legend, and a good one, too, a clean, smart, always on the side of right guy. That's a good friend for your children. Greatest of them all, Toscanini. Now, where else could you see this?
And that's a couple of minutes out of this promotional film from RCA featuring Dave Garraway. And let me talk about Dave first with you, James. Yeah. Dave Garraway was the original host of The Today Show, one of the creations of Pat Weaver that you mentioned earlier. One thing I noticed about him, besides the fact he's walking around with what was then the equivalent of a lapel mic, although it was very big and ungainly, sort of balanced on his chest, is that he's very low-key, very informal. And maybe not something that, maybe not a sort of voice that existed in broadcasting so much before.
Well, he got his start in the Chicago doing a jazz show, a jazz music program. He was an old radio DJ. And if you think about it, he has a kind of a DJ voice, that kind of soft, anticipates sort of the FM DJ that you and I may have grown up with, very soft and like this, Jim, and now for our next, you know, sort of thing.
And this show, the Today Show, is still running, and it has a lot of imitators on the other networks. Is the shows, the morning shows we see now in the 21st century, do they have identifiable roots in that original Today Show?
Well, I think that I'd have to go back to Pat Weaver, who conceived of the program, although thank heavens they didn't use the title he proposed, which was Rise and Shine. For the program, but stuck with Today. Weaver himself expressed some dismay late in his life. Weaver, you know, only died a few years ago, but Weaver expressed some dismay that the program today has too much. It isn't as serious a program as he wanted it to be. That the news agenda has been watered down too much, promotional material, and so forth. I think, by the way, it'd be a great book to be written about how the Today Show has changed over time. Not one of those gossipy, you know, beach books that get written every now and then that talks about Deborah Norville, but actually talks about the agenda today, the guests on Today Show. It was a different show in its first 10, 20 years, a more serious show for good or ill.
But I understand before that show came on, there wasn't really an idea that appreciable amounts of people would watch TV at that time.
No, there wasn't. And NBC lost money on Today for certainly its first year. The idea was this. the idea was that people only watch television in the evening. Kids might turn on the TV in the afternoon to watch, kid shows and stuff. But the operating assumption, certainly in the advertising community, was nobody would turn on the set, as we used to say, to watch a program. And NBC really had to fight to sell advertising for the show because people didn't believe that people were watching. And indeed, I might point out, as I do in the book, a number of NBC affiliates wouldn't carry the program. They didn't, they weren't prepared to make the commitment.
Pat Weaver also opened up another time slot in television viewing. That was late night with the development of The Tonight Show.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. Late in the construction of my book, I picked up one of those titles, Inventing Late Night. I'm looking at it right now, which argues that Weaver really took that from the NBC station in New York. In other words, the program and the host, Steve Allen, were already in place, and he simply gave it a national feed, put it on nationally. And Weaver had a habit, and I say this with great affection and respect for the man, but he had a habit of taking more credit than he should have for The Tonight Show.
It's, I guess, The Tonight Show, when these talk shows were 90 minutes long, they were a little more low-key than they are now.
Yes.
But there's still the idea. It seems to be a very durable format, and there must be about six or seven of these shows now working in a couple of time slots.
Right. And they're relatively inexpensive. That's a point worth noting. They certainly were in those days. They didn't cost that much to produce, even when you factor in the talent that the host cost. They were relatively, as I say, relatively reasonable.
We're talking with James Boffman, author of Same Time, Same Station, Creating American Television, 1948-61. If you have any questions for Professor Boffman, you can call in. The number here at the Afternoon Magazine, 333-9455. Or if you're calling from out of town, you can call toll-free at 800-222-9455. The other development you write about with Pat Weaver was the one that didn't quite work, and that was the idea of TV spectaculars. And
yes.
when I had used to read about these things in passing, I thought they were more like special programs that you would see from time to time. But it seems more like Pat Weaver's idea was to have special programs all the time.
Quite often, so many times a month, a much higher. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but, of course, he anticipated eventually that there'd be spectaculars running every week. Weaver was convinced, and this is and interesting to think about in retrospect, he was convinced that people would tire of television if it weren't more ambitious, if it just relied on the weekly series. Weaver, for example, never really believed in the situation comedy. He admired I Love Lucy. NBC tried to get that show, actually, before it went on CBS. But he didn't think, he thought the same time, same station model, which CBS adhered to, would wear out its welcome.
He didn't think that TV would work like radio.
Right, right. And he was convinced that in other words, he thought that demand for television was elastic, that people would simply consume less television if it didn't take more chances. And again, in retrospect, he was proven wrong. The spectacular strategy, mounting these 90-minute live productions like Peter Pan, although Peter Pan was the far and away the most successful of the shows, he was convinced that's what television had to do, or people would stop watching television.
This is you mentioned earlier that TV took a lot of its structure from Hollywood, and this sounds like it might have been one of those ideas that essentially you should treat TV like the movies, and there's something different all the time, and there are different events competing to be bigger and more spectacular than everything else.
Well, actually, I would differ slightly. I think what Weaver imagined and those around him was TV would rely more on the legitimate theater, more on Broadway. These were men and women who lived in New York, who really thought that Broadway was the was among the cultural forms available was the highest. And so they envisioned Broadway as a model, and I might say musical revues that you might see in a big nightclub as a model for what television should do.
So that's where the idea for the variety shows came, and also the dramatic anthologies which existed in the 1950s.
Yes, and again, another form from radio, initially live dramas, 30 or 60 minutes long. Rod Serling, who will be familiar to many of your listeners, was a writer for radio dramas, and CBS and NBC had both aired many, and ABC had aired a lot of these dramas in the 40s.
Now, listening to that little film clip from the RCA film with Dave Garraway, if you watch the entire film, you know they talk about kids shows, they talk about cowboy shows. They talk about crime dramas. They talk about, they have Groucho Marx's game show, You Bet Your Life. They don't include any of the high-class dramas. Was that a hint that NBC didn't have much faith in that product?
Well, now you've got me on the spot here, and so I'm going to have to guess. But Jim, my sense is that it probably reflected the following. The marketing people at RCA probably assumed that wealthy people already had televisions. The wealthy elite that might, the audience that might be watching the live dramas already had TVs. And that would be a guess on my part. I'd have to think some more about that. Of course, a number of, and I mentioned this in the book, a number of very educated people during this period refused to buy televisions. So I would have included live drama, maybe very quickly, in the marketing pitch. And we have live drama.
The film does include Toscanini, so
yeah,
there is.
Well, and of course he was also under contract with RCA, so that was part of the synergy that the General Sarnoff, who ran NBC and CBS, or excuse me, and RCA, cultivated.
The live dramas, went on for several years in the 1950s, and I got the impression that culturally they had a certain impact at that time.
Well, they did, and they were appointment viewing for a lot of people. They ran longer than you may realize. I mean, the Kraft drama program, I think, was launched around 47. It was one of the oldest, one of the first shows on NBC, I believe, but Studio One on CBS was one of the original programs, and they enjoyed a run, many of them, of 10 years or more. There were some spectacularly successful ones that Pat H. Chayefsky and Rod Serling wrote. The most remembered from that period was a program called Marty, about a butcher in the Bronx, but there were others. Rod Serling wrote some very well-regarded ones. Gore Vidal wrote some. Many of them were quite memorable. Many of them are quite forgettable. I've read a lot of the scripts for those. But for the fact that I was able to do it in the Westwood neighborhood of Los Angeles, it would have been a real ordeal.
And, you know, I'm holding in my hands right now an anthology of TV scripts. The Harcourt Brace Awards Best Television Plays 1957, actually a juried competition for television plays. John Houseman was one of the judges.
Yes.
First place winner was Rod Serling's Requiem for a Heavyweight,
which
I remember becoming a film. And the idea that you would do this, that you would put television plays in a book, made a suggestion about, I guess, the ambitions of the people doing the shows and how seriously people took them at the time.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And, of course, that program died pretty quickly. I mean, I think it was disbanded within a year or two because the dramas virtually disappeared from the network schedule, Playhouse 90 being one of the very last to leave the air.
I want to play another little clip right now, and this is actually from a Rod Serling drama for Playhouse 90. It was a drama called the Velvet Alley, and it seems to have been about the TV business. And the clip we're going to hear, the actor is Leslie Nielsen, who's known for broad comedy now,
yes,
but then was a dramatic actor. He is playing a TV producer who's, well, he's beginning to crack up. He's trying to land this important writer. He's they're meeting at a bar. He's had a little too much to drink, and he's talking about the business.
If I could tell you some of the battles that I've had up in that front office just to protect the writer, okay? Like with that programming head that they got out there. I mean, what does he know about creative people, Travis? I mean, when my option came up last year, who fought against it? Who called me a lush? Well, he said a lush. Unreliable, right? That's what he said. Unreliable. Me, I've been in the theater since I was 21 years old, Ernie. I did television in the days when they only had one camera and a budget of 15 cents and actors who worked for nothing. Eddie, I haven't got much time. What do you mean? What do you mean you don't have time? What do you mean you don't have time? And believe me, if you've got time, I have. I'm the one who doesn't have the time. Ernie, I'm over the hill at 37 years old. You know, I've done too many shows. I've read too many scripts. I've tried to think of too many new ideas. I'm dried up. But I used to be a dynamo, a perpetual motion machine, I used to think. You see, Ernie, the trouble is that there's just too many hours to fill on that little old screen. When you've tried to fill them for so many years, you dry up, you know, the old well runs dry. You see, and that's when we turn to fellas like you, Ernie. Come out here. Help keep us going. Give us new ideas. We lean on you a little bit. Still leaning on this.
And that's Leslie Nielsen. He was talking to Art Carney in that short scene. And he seems to have a lot of what you described, somebody from a theater background, somebody who's worked in TV drama since the early years, and he's becoming overwhelmed with all the product he has to put out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Serling was increasingly disillusioned. You don't happen to know the year that came out?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Okay.
Late 50s, that's all I can tell you.
I mean, Serling was clearly, as time went by, was growing frustrated. A lot of writers, in effect, were seeing their hopes for the medium being diminished or decline, if a hope could decline. I mean, they were I think, increasingly frustrated by what they perceived to be the direction of television. What they didn't understand, and I talk about this in the book, is that it really wasn't the network's fault, it was the market's fault. The market was changing on them, and so they were losing audience share as I mentioned earlier, as TV began to enter these smaller markets. We really found those dramas that might have appealed to you and me at that moment in our lives to be unappealing. The other thing I might point out, I spent a lot of time reading Serling scripts, and just and I'm an admirer of Serling. I grew up watching The Twilight Zone, and that's a series I can watch in reruns. But, boy, a lot of his TV plays were very, very humorless. I mean, there was not much humanity in them. They dealt with serious topics, and Serling clearly had aspirations, and I admire him for that. But, boy, you wanted to have a drink or something when you're watching it. You know, people are just unrelentingly serious and dour it's just something I noticed that I didn't get into, I think, in the book that struck me.
We have a patient listener from Eureka who's called up to talk to you, Professor Boffman. And
sure.
Good afternoon. You're on Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you. An interesting conversation. I just had a couple little tidbits that came to mind, and I know I'm an admirer of the original Twilight Zone by Rod Serling. Was that in radio before it was on television?
Well, it was not. Although Serling first pitched that around 1950, there may have been a prototype on radio. It was not on radio, is what I'm thinking. But I know when he first pitched it, he was himself still working in radio. You may know, sir, there are two really good biographies of Serling out that I would recommend to you, and that both of which talk about the origins of the show, but he came up with the idea years before it went on the air.
And I was just trying to think back. Steve Allen was the first host of The Tonight Show, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
And did Jack Parr follow him, or was there somebody else in between?
There was an interregnum. Alan was persuaded to get this, and you may be old enough to know what a kamikaze mission this was. He was persuaded to confront Ed Sullivan, to take on Ed Sullivan with his own variety show. And so he went off The Tonight Show, and then they had about a year's interval where they experimented with different hosts. They even tried to originate the program from different cities, including Chicago. Some of your listeners may remember this. And then they settled on Jack Parr. But there was about I want to say that Alan went off in 56, and it was about a year before Parr did.
Thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you. And, looking at some of the dramas, I remember... You know, I never saw Marty, but I remember seeing parodies of Marty. I remember seeing a Three Stooges short from the late 50s where they were aping lines from Marty. And apparently there was a certain catchphrase of ennui and, you know, idle blue-collar banter about what you're going to do tonight. I don't know. What do you want to do tonight? That sort
right,
of thing.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, that suggests a certain sort of impact, even though the market didn't ultimately support that sort of drama to any large degree.
Absolutely. And again, I mean, Marty, a lot of the dramas were rating successes in the early 50s. The ratings really start to fall in the middle of the decade, and then they just collapse for most of them by the end of the decade. And a lot of this has to do, as I said, with the spread of TV into smaller markets. Also, the programming strategies of ABC have a lot to do with it, because ABC says, to heck with live drama, we can't do it. We're gonna offer westerns and then detective shows, and people suddenly discovered that's what they preferred.
ABC was also the first network to ally with a movie studio, and not a large one, but yes. with Walt Disney Productions at the time.
Yes.
And until then, the big Hollywood studios had pretty much just seen TV as a rival and stayed clear.
Well, again, you're right. And ABC it is interesting. You know, NBC approached all of the studios initially, including Weaver, who didn't trust the studios. And the studios were waiting for the terms of trade to turn in their favor. They didn't take, you know, they were waiting for TV to reach a certain penetration rate, I think, before they would concede. But I really don't think the studios did a very good job. Disney did a brilliant job managing television, and without admiring Disney in other ways, he was a brilliant business person in that regard. He understood TV's possibilities and how it could benefit him as well as ABC.
You know, we're at a time now where all the companies that own TV networks also own movie studios, and the combination seems pretty routine. Why did it not seem routine then?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is that I think, and some of my brethren in communication departments are going to disagree with me, and I hope they're not listening, but I think the studios were stupid. I think if they'd been smart, they would have understood that you could achieve synergies, you could achieve great success by in effect, entering TV directly, either owning a network or owning stations. But most of the studios were too tentative. They lacked Walt Disney's vision and so forth. The other thing, though, that has to be conceded is that even if the studios had wanted to enter TV in a full frontal assault, the way Disney just bought ABC in 96, I think the Justice Department at the time might have objected. I know it's quaint, and younger listeners will be confused, but this was a moment in American history, that is the 1950s, when the Justice Department and the Federal Communications Commission worried about cross-ownership. They worried about a major studio, say MGM, owning ABC or owning the Dumont Network. So that was a secondary consideration weighing, I think, in some minds. But I think primarily it was just a lack of imagination and on the part of the industry. And, you know,
I want to spend the last few minutes of our interview talking about the parts of the industry that did not make so much money, but still existed, maybe not for commercial reasons, but because of other pressures. And that was the cultural and the news programming that the networks did at that time. How much of that was done because they felt they had to do it because of outside pressures, and how much was because it was a feeling of themselves that, you know, this was a good thing to do to as a matter of prestige?
Well, if you're talking about the news and cultural programming, I think primarily was regarded as an obligation. And it was done often on the cheap for that reason. That is to say, this is a period in broadcast history in the United States when the stations, including those owned by the networks, were regulated. And this is another point that's all but disappeared. The networks were much more self-conscious about their place among the opinion elite in the country. They wanted to make sure that they had the goodwill of members of Congress. The TV columnist for the New York Times and the late, great New York Herald Tribune. And that's a self-consciousness that's all but disappeared now. I mean, the networks could give a patootie about that. It's a combination of concern about regulation, you know, if we don't do this, because it had been a regulatory expectation from the late 20s that stations would have to offer some news. But I think it was primarily a sense of this will assure our place in culture, you know, among the cultural elite, and protect us. Because in the back of their minds was always the possibility that if they didn't behave in this fashion, we would end up with a federal broadcast network. We would end up with an American BBC.
You close your book on a pessimistic note, essentially writing about how today, you know, a half a century after all these events, TV hasn't lived up to the early hopes and ambitions that people had for it. And I was wondering, is there the same sort of connection with TV coming on in so many platforms today? There are so many channels, even more channels on broadcast than there used to be, but also cable and satellite channel, home video, DVDs, very easy to get, video coming in through the internet. Can we draw a straight line between the medium of TV today and the days when even a big city might not have half a dozen channels?
Right. Well, I think we could draw that line, and I'm struck by your finding the end pessimistic or, you know, dour. I guess it does end on that note. I think that in so many ways, we have so many more cultural choices than we did in the 1950s. I think growing up in a market, northeastern Ohio, where we had, in effect, three stations, and that was it. And they were all commercial stations, and you were, in effect, that was your choice. By the same token, what's the delicious and perhaps sad irony to TV in the 50s is the beauty of what people like Weaver and occasionally Bill Paley at CBS tried to do is precisely because of that limited number of choices, you might end up being exposed to Shakespeare by mistake. That's not going to happen today.
If you're going to get Shakespeare on TV right now, it's because you were probably looking for it.
Yep. And I can remember we had a sitter when my parents would go out to party with their friends in the 60s. I decided to have a high cultural moment and watch a CBS production of Midsummer's Dream, something like that. And our sitter, who was a wonderful woman but never watched Shakespeare, she preferred Lawrence Welk, sat down with me and just started watching it and laughing, enjoying it immensely. Those moments are gone now. You know, we've achieved the choice that we wanted, but those possibilities of accidental enlightenment, which was something that Weaver championed, aren't going to come again.
Well, James Boffman, thank you very much for talking with us, and I want to apologize to the caller who just called in the last moment. We are out of time, but thank you for talking with us about your new book, Same Time, Same Station: Creating American Television, 1948 to 1961, published by Johns Hopkins University Press.